I had to get a little tickled earlier when we were having communion, when Lonnie and I were sitting up and Mark was going to bring the bread up to us, and he just skipped up the steps. I just didn't know a man his age could move that quickly. That was very, very impressive. Speaking of age, Percy and Florence Arrowsmith held two Guinness Book of World Records. One was for the longest marriage of a living couple, 80 years. They were married 80 years together. And they also held the record for the oldest aggregate age of a married couple. Together, they had lived 205 years. Now, both of them are gone now, but what a wonderful testimony to the a lifelong commitment, to be sure, of what marriage is to be. They were both asked, when they were included in the book, what it was that they attributed their lengthy marriage to. Well, Florence said this: "You must never go to sleep bad friends. If you've had a quarrel, you make up. Never be afraid to say, 'I'm sorry.'" This is pretty good advice. Now, Percy sort of boiled his advice down a little bit shorter. He said that two magic words that explained his long marriage: "Yes, dear." That was the explanation that he gave, which kind of reminds me of another couple that were celebrating their golden anniversary, just, you know, Johnny come latelys as far as compared to the Arrowsmiths, but they were having their 50th wedding anniversary, and they were asked, "What do you attribute your long marriage to?" And the man said, "Well, training." And they said, "Training?" He said, "Yeah, training. My wife has a PhD in communication, and I majored in theater arts, so she's really good at communicating, and I'm good at acting like I'm listening." Now, that probably not nearly as good of advice as the first one. We continue with our look at God at home, what our faith should be doing at home to help us in our marriage relationships. And this morning, I want to have a word about words, or as I've titled the lesson, Straight Talk on Straight Talk. Now, there is a proverb that we often use when we're trying to calm down kids that have had their feelings hurt by something somebody has said. And that proverb is, not from the book of Proverbs, but a folk proverb: "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never harm me." I remember years ago, Steve Martin was doing a routine where he was acting like he was a televangelist that had just been interviewed by a magazine and didn't like the interview that came out. And he said, "That interview was full of lies and made-up facts. If I had known they was going to print all that, I would not have lied or made up facts." Well, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never harm me. That's lies and made up facts. In fact, the book of Proverbs says just the opposite. Proverbs 11, verse 9, "With their mouths the godless destroy their neighbors, but through knowledge the righteous escape." Proverbs 12 and verse 6, "The words of the wicked lie in wait for blood, but the speech of the upright rescues them." And Proverbs 12 and verse 18, "The words of the reckless pierce like swords, but the tongue of the wise brings healing." And finally, chapter 15, verse 4, "The soothing tongue is a tree of life, but a perverse tongue crushes the spirit." Well, all of that, and others we could mention, it's just the opposite from "words will never hurt me," right? Words can be extremely damaging. And in all of those proverbs, there's a comparison between the righteous who use words helpfully and to soothe and to heal and to rescue, and the wicked who use their words like spears to pierce, that crush the spirit and all of that. So there is a power in words. In fact, that is going to come out tonight in a text that the small group here is going to look at a little more detailed. But James says the tongue has great power. In fact, the tongue's a small thing, compared to the body, just like the bit in a horse's mouth is pretty small, but that bit can control that huge animal wherever the rider wants to go. And compared to the whole great ship, the rudder is very small, but it's the rudder that decides where the whole ship is going to go. And a spark may start out very small, but it can light a whole forest on fire. Yeah, our words may seem to be trivial. In fact, we sometimes trivialize. We say something hurtful, and we say, "Oh, I'm just saying," or "I didn't mean anything by it," or "I'm just kidding." But those words can be extremely powerful. James goes on to say, James 3, verse right after he makes those comparisons, verse 7, all kinds of animals, birds and reptiles and sea creatures are being tamed and have been tamed by mankind, but no human being can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. It is simply not the case that words cannot hurt us. They hurt us all the time. And in marriages, the words that we use can be extremely hurtful. And so that's why I want to do some straight talk about straight talk today. The last couple of weeks, we've looked at Ephesians chapter 5 and what Paul says about mutual submission in marriage, and what he says directly to wives and what he says directly to husbands in a large section of Ephesians 5. But you know, there's something that comes before Ephesians 5, and that is Ephesians 4. And he says some things there that are going to help us in marriage. He starts off talking about change that has to happen when we come to Christ, that we don't come to Christ to stay the same, but to be transformed. So in chapter 4, verse 22, you were taught with regard to your former way of life to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its evil, deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your mind, and to put on a new self created like God in true righteousness and holiness. We don't come to Christ just to change our thinking about Christ. We do, of course. We come to have faith in Jesus, that He is the Son of God. But that changes not just our views, it changes our attitudes. The ladies are looking at this on Tuesday mornings in their class, how we can change our attitudes. But Paul's point is, it's not just our attitudes change, because our attitudes are changed by our faith in Jesus. That changes the way that we're going to act. And then he's going to talk about in a little bit of detail what that's going to mean. There's an old story from St. Augustine that Augustine, if you don't know, or Augustine, was quite a character in his early life. He spent a lot of his early years just looking for every sort of sensual pleasure and that kind of thing. His mother was a faithful Christian, Monica, and she prayed for him constantly. And he finally came to believe in Christ and would later become one of the dominant thinkers in the pre-medieval period for Christianity. Wrote an awful lot. But he tells this story that shortly after his conversion, he's walking down the street and he meets a former mistress. And she tries to get his attention. And she kept saying, "Augustine, it is I. Augustine, it is I." And finally he turns and says, "Yes, madam, but it is not I." See, he's been transformed. He's not the same person that he was when he was together, and he does not want to be drawn into that old lifestyle. We are to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. And that's going to transform the way that we are in our marriages. And so he's going to talk about some of the ways that words are used now that we're new people with that new attitude. That not only our actions change, but part of those actions that change are the words that we use. Now, he's talking about here things in general Christian life, the way our words change in relationship to everyone, particularly in the church. But if we are family, which we are, as Roger mentioned earlier, and because of that we act differently toward one another, like in the way that we use words, shouldn't it be even more important that our words are transformed in the way that we use them at home? So I want to notice three texts that Paul is going to use, and he is going to use them particularly in the way that we, I'm going to use them particularly in the way that we relate to one another in marriage. First of all, he suggests that we should tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So in verse 25, he says, "Therefore, each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to his neighbor, for we are members of one body." Now, again, he's talking about our relationships in with other Christians, and he says, you can't lie to each other because you're members of the same body. Well, that's even more critical when you're talking about people that are one flesh. They have this relationship, this forever relationship in marriage. You see, because when you lie, you don't just lie. You lie to someone. It's always a relational sin, right? Where I don't think enough of you to tell you the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so I'll try to find some way to either change what I'm telling you or cause you to think that I'm saying something different so that our situation is a little bit easier to deal with. Paul says, put off all falsehood. All falsehood. In fact, Revelation 21:8 says that all liars are going to have their... All falsehood. All liars. Well, does that mean maybe there's some different kinds of liars? That there are different kinds of lies? I mean, we put them in categories because that makes them a little easier for us to deal with. Like there are bald-faced lies. That goes back to the time when, that expression goes back to the time when most men wore beards. And so a bald-faced lie would be like a guy shaving off his beard and then daring you not to notice it. A bald-faced lie, and we kind of changed that to make more sense, a bold-faced lie where you just lie to somebody's face. I didn't do that, but you did it. I didn't mean it, but you did. I was just kidding, but you weren't. Just telling out-and-out lies to each other in our marriages is deadly to relationships. Marriage is built on trust. Trust is a foundation, and trust is so hard to build, but so easy to tear down. And if we don't love one... Remember, Paul said, don't lie to each other because you're members of the same body. Well, husbands and wives, unlike any other relationship, are literally one flesh of the same body. And so when husbands and wives lie to each other like that, it is deadly, devastating to the relationship. But see, we pretty much all would say that lying is wrong, this bald-faced lying. But see, we come up with other categories to make it a little bit easier. We have what I'm calling misrepresenting, because that's what fit on the slide. But, you know, you sort of twist the fact. You say what's literally true, but you say it in a certain way so that somebody may take it the wrong way. So you say one thing, literally, that's the truth, but you're hoping that they get the... Let me use an illustration. Suppose Lynn has been wanting me to go to the doctor to get a physical, as it is. We do that every year, so she wouldn't have to do that. But we're just making this up. So she's wanting me to go to the doctor, and so finally, after a while, I do go to the doctor, and the doctor examines me, looks at the information. He says, "Boy, you really put on some weight. I can't believe how much weight you've put on. I'm surprised that the cops haven't been called in for crowd control. You're so large, you're a crowd just in yourself. I can't believe a man your age is in such shape." And then he prescribes a bunch of stuff, puts me on a diet, and sends me home. Well, I don't want to tell Lynn that because, you know, who wants to eat like straw all the time? And so she said, "What did the doctor say?" And I say, "Well, the doctor said he can't believe a man my age is in this shape." That's a direct quote, right? But see, I'm using it so that it gives her the wrong impression. Technically true, but you know, there's a couple of words that we use for that. Number one, that's like politics, right? Isn't that what politicians do all the time? They want you to think that they agree with you on everything, so they frame their words so that everybody thinks. See, there's another technical expression for what it's called when you tell something that's technically true, but you're hoping it misleads someone. It's called a lie. That's what it's called. And husbands and wives must not lie to each other. They must tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Well, there's another kind of lie that we have a hard time with. It's called a white lie. Now, a white lie, we've convinced ourselves the reason we tell the lie is because we don't want to hurt the other person's feelings. You know, it's easier on the other person if we tell a strategic falsehood to lead them to feel better about themselves. But in reality, that's not the case at all. Remember that old Geico commercial that was just great? When Honest Abe is there and his wife is standing in front of the mirror and she's looking at herself in this dress. And she says, "Abe, does this dress make me look fat?" Well, immediately he's lost. You know, Honest Abe is not going to tell a lie. And so he just goes, and finally she storms out. You see, we think that if we say, "Oh, no, honey, that looks..." Do we not love one another enough to be truthful? Now, we shouldn't be blunt, you know, and say, "Well, honey, it's not the dress." You know, because, you know, we don't want to die. But what Paul says also in Ephesians 4 is part of maturing, part of growing up in Christ, is getting to the point where we can speak the truth in love. And it is always devastating to relationships to not value the other person to be truthful to them. And so, always tell the truth. Secondly, Paul talks about using our words that build up rather than tear down. So in Ephesians 4 and verse 29, "Do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouth, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it will benefit those who listen." Okay, again, this is spoken in our, you know, for general relationships in Christ, but it's even more important when we're talking about husbands and wives, that our language, you know, sometimes we say things because it makes us feel good to say them. Steam is building up and you just blurt something out. Boy, you feel so much better for a second. But Paul says, no, the words that you use, make sure you're using those words to build others up so that it may benefit the one that listens. That means that everything that I say should be filtered through how I think it's going to be heard by the person I'm saying it to. That it better be for their bit. It better, when I'm talking to my wife, it better be things that are going to benefit her and not things. I remember when I violated this principle, like yesterday. It's just so hard, isn't it? But I remember we're having a discussion, and it wasn't an argument yet. It became one because of what I'm going to say. We were just disagreeing, and I was trying to get her to, and I can't even remember what it was, but she kept throwing me these softballs. I mean, I'm a little sarcastic. Okay, I'm a lot sarcastic by nature. And she was giving me these perfect one-liner responses. That just, and I resisted the first one. I resisted the second one. But the third one was just so good. I had to respond with this smart-aleck answer. And, of course, then it became an argument. You don't say things because they feel good to say. Don't let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouth. The New Living Translation has abusive there. But the word is actually the word for rotting, for, you know, a corpse that's rotting. Don't let any rotten words come out of your mouth. Things that tear down, but rather things that build up. Paul is going to use an illustration, again, that has to do with our influence with other people outside of Christ. But again, what a great application it has for our marriages. Be wise in the way you act toward outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation, and the word there is just the word for words, logos, the word for word. Let your words be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. So in our Christian lives, when we're dealing with people outside of the faith, we need to be very careful. We need to measure our words, again, realizing how those words are going to land on other people. Because if we speak without thinking, we're going to not make use of every opportunity. We're going to blow opportunities to speak a good word for Jesus. So we need to season every word that we say. But you know, every conversation we have with our spouse, we have an opportunity to deepen our relationship or to set it back. Does that mean we need to season our words? Absolutely. I need to realize that those words have power. And because those words have power, I need to use them carefully. Now, that doesn't mean we have to walk on eggshells all the time because we can't live doing that. But everything that we say to one another must be, again, filtered through that filter of trying to build up our relationship rather than looking for ways to tear it down. And then finally, we need to be particularly careful of that when we're angry. So Paul says in chapter 4, verse 31, get rid of all bitterness, rage, and anger, brawling, and slander, along with every form of malice. Okay, he's already said, don't let the sun go down. That's in the same context. He comes back to anger here and says, particularly when you're using words while you're angry, oh, be very, very careful then. Anger is like alcohol. It tends to break down inhibitions. You know, when we get really, really angry, we say we're mad. Well, the etymology of that is it goes back to being crazy, right? A person was mad when you put them in an asylum. What happens when you're mad? There's no control over what you say. So we need to be very careful about how we use our words when we're angry. I mean, okay, have you ever said anything that you really wish you hadn't said, but you said it because you were angry? I mean, we do that all the time. Why? Because our inhibitions are brought down. And we might even say the unvarnished real us kind of bubbles to the surface. You can't season your words if you let them fly without giving thought to them. And that's what happens when we're mad. I'm using myself as a bad illustration a lot this morning. But we had an argument, and I was apologizing. I'm very good at apologizing. I've had lots of practice. And I said to Lynn, honey, I really didn't mean to say that. And she said, yes, you did. You just don't mean it now. It's just hard to deal with that kind of wisdom. you know. And it's true. In the middle of the argument, we don't let our thinking center allow us to measure those words so that they impact the one that we love with the kind of positive that Paul was talking about earlier. And so here he goes through kind of a litany of synonyms, the different kind of anger, and how words are used in anger. Get rid of all bitterness. This is when you hold a grudge and you bring up the last time they said something like that. Though Paul says love keeps no record of wrongs, we have a tendency to be pretty good accountants in keeping track of those things. So get rid of the bitterness. Rage. Rage is when we just blow up and say whatever comes to our mind when we're angry. And brawling. Brawling is the kind of attitude where we quickly pick up the fight. Right? Someone that likes to argue and is just looking for an excuse. And slander, those are the ugly things that we say when we're in the middle of anger. And then every form of malice. Malice is like, you know, vengeance and a dish that's best served cold. You know? Get rid of all those kinds of things. And right in the middle of that, we skipped over, is the general word for anger. So if you don't think you're guilty of all the rest of them, then there's just plain old anger. Be sure that you measure your words when it comes to anger. We sometimes say that talk is cheap. And by that, it's a lot easier to say the right things sometimes than to do the right things. But understand, according to what we said here this morning, talk is anything but cheap. That it has a dramatic impact on the relationships that we live out together, both in Christ as God's family, but particularly at home in our marriages. Our words can build up our spouse and deepen our relationships, but negative, damaging words can pick at the fringes of our relationship until it is frayed, until it comes apart. Words are powerful things. If you want a great marriage, then very carefully choose your spouse. But see, for most of us, if you're married, that's too late. So the next best thing is to carefully choose your words. Because assuming that you're communicating at all, then the interactions that we have day by day take place at least first through words. And so those words can build up, or those words can tear down. And Paul wants us to be very careful about the way that we use words. In fact, there's wider application. In 1 Peter 4 and verse 11, Peter says, if anyone speaks, they should do so as one who speaks the very words of God. If anyone serves, they should do so with the strength that God provides, so that in all things God may be praised through Christ or through Jesus Christ. We speak the very words of God. In our interactions with the world in general, there are times when we have the chance to speak God's words. We become the mouthperson of God, speaking that good word for Christ at just the right time. We can show the world who Jesus is. The song we're getting ready to sing uses these words: reach with our hands, touch this city. Lord, let our mouths speak your truth. Words are so important. God allows us to speak his words. The question is, are we going to be willing to do that? As we sing this song together, let it be a challenge to us. Are we really opening ourselves up to be the servants of God that he wants us to be? And if there are changes that we need to make, let's be willing to do that.